Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join Anne Norton, Miriam Francois, and Saeed Khan for a fascinating discussion about the current state of democracy in the modern world, how we can navigate a world where the truth is not at all what it seems, and what future alternative systems could look like. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, our panel consider whether we are heading towards a world of mass surveillance, disinformation, and repressive regimentation of people and behaviours within society.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here at the Bradford Literature Festival. My name is Saeed Khan. I come to you by way of Wayne State University in Detroit. Always a pleasure to be back in the North in general, in the UK, as well as here in Bradford. For those of you who are attending your first festival, welcome. For those of you who are seasoned veterans, here we are in the 10th anniversary of the BLF. Welcome back. We are entering a topic which I'm sure not only drew you because of your interest in it, but one that seems to be mutating every day in the news cycle. It occurs to me that at the time of the end of the Cold War, Francis Fukuyama, in his book The End of History and the Last Man, wrote with great exaltation that history, in fact, had ended, and that with the defeat of the Soviet Union, now liberal democracy had won, and we were now entering into a period of 1,000 years of peace, or something along those lines. Boy, was he wrong. Not only with the developments of the 1990s and, of course, the early part of the 21st century, but what some might even argue now is a certain catalyst which then challenges the very notions, structures, and foundations of liberal democracy. As we've seen in countries like the United States, some of you might have actually seen a debate. If you were up at 2 o'clock in the morning, as I was watching former President Trump and President Biden, you couldn't fall asleep afterwards. It was quite jarring. And I know here there's, of course, elections happening. But if you look in many parts of what are sometimes described to be the Western world, you see agitations, you see flare-ups, and you see events that are now starting to question whether those foundations of liberal democracy are in fact strong enough to withstand the onslaught that is happening. Which then, of course, begs the question of today's session: are we now witnessing the end of liberal democracy? And by the way, we didn't name the title of this in a provocative way on purpose as an alarmist perspective, but really trying to then go ahead and ask these difficult questions, especially when it seems as though others may not be. So we are joined with really some spectacular experts on the topic of liberal democracy, political, social, and cultural currents. Today's discussion is actually going to be centered around the contribution made by one of our esteemed experts, and that is a book called Wild Democracy, Anarchy, Courage, and Ruling the Law by Professor Anne Norton, who is the Stacy and Henry Jackson President's Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, with a focus on political identity. And some of her books, along with the current Wild Democracy, include Leo Strauss and The Politics of American Empire, which was published in 2004, The Muslim Question, published in 2013, and of course, Wild Democracy, which was published last year. We're also joined by Dr. Miriam Francois, who's a journalist, a filmmaker, and a writer. Last year, she made her directorial debut for her own MPWR Productions, which specializes in documentary films, which center the voices of minority communities. Her directorial debut was with the award-winning documentary Finding Allah. She is also the producer of The Stream on Al Jazeera.
Presenter.
And then finally, we have Dr. Salman Sayed, who is the professor of social thought and decolonial thought at the University of Leeds. Some of his publications include A Fundamental Fear and Recalling the Caliphate. He's also the founding editor of Reorient, which is a premier journal on the emerging field of critical Muslim studies, for which he is the director of the Critical Muslim Studies International Conference, which just concluded its third iteration a few days ago. He's also the founder of Radio Reorient, which is a platform for bringing together and putting forward different elements of critical Muslim studies as a field of thought and study, including podcasts and a website. So welcome all of you to this discussion about whether or not we are looking at the end of liberal democracy. So you have been, I'm sure, a very keen witness as well as student of what has been going on in the news cycle, not only this past week, but really a longer arc of it. Where do you place, shall we say, if you had to triage, the status and the condition of liberal democracy today?
Well, the problem with liberal democracy for me is that those two words don't really go very well together. And I am an open partisan of the democratic. That is to say, I think that the people should rule. And that they should rule with a minimum intervention from other sources. So the two threats to democracy for me are, on the one hand, authoritarianism, which is the great threat in the world, but also, frankly, the looming threat in the United States, and liberalism, which is a much more seductive kind of threat, but both of these arise out of a fear of the people. And putting it that way, in that nice 18th century kind of way, the people, I think disguises who it's actually fear of. It is to say, it's fear of you. It's not some abstraction, some sovereign that hovers over the people. It's fear of ordinary people in their ordinary lives. And so when I think of the end of liberal democracy, part of me worries that this means authoritarianism, and part of me looks to this as a potential opening. That is to say, what if people could think about themselves governing themselves, being ungoverned in important ways, and sever themselves from the need to restrain one another and fear one another in the ways that they do. So part of me is watching, frankly, with the same kinds of anxiety that I share with virtually all my country. And part of me looks at certain developments in the news cycle, like the very unexpected to me uprisings in my campus and around the United States and around the world, or the Palestinian people. And that seems to me to be an opening. So I have, in these darkest of times, some hope.
Miriam, you've done a lot of coverage in not only this country, but also in France. And part of that has included these popular expressions of people who are clearly dissatisfied with the status quo. You've covered demonstrations, you've covered marches and processions, and you've also covered the reactions of the state and security apparatus to that. So I was wondering, how do you see this fitting in with Anne's assessment?
Well, I completely share Anne's assessment, actually, which is, I was thinking about your question when you first posed it of, you know, is it the end of liberal democracy? And I was thinking to myself, okay, so, you know, democracy, demos, the idea of kind of rule by the people, for the people. When was the last time in my lifetime that I could remember thinking of a government that really represented the needs, priorities, fulfilled the basic requirements of the majority of the people, both in this country, but also my country of origin, France, despite my accent, that is the one. And certainly not in my lifetime. And I know there's a tendency to always be critical of power when you're close to it, meaning every generation feels like their governments are not representative. But we find ourselves today in a situation where, you know, 1% of the world owns almost half of the wealth globally. That pattern has been getting starker over the last decade. Oxfam's been raising the alarm. If you follow their sort of, I think, their annual reports on this global inequality, you will have watched this sort of trend exacerbated over the last few years. And so alongside what we have, which is clearly growing economic inequality, which is a fundamental basis for an equal society, right? So for a society in which everyone can participate equally, people need to not be worrying about their children going hungry. People need to not be worrying about whether or not they can heat their homes and not die of cold, which, as you all know, happens in this country. And so it feels to me that it's been a long time that democracy has not been functioning, just to list those two elements. Then when you look a little bit deeper, you look at things like the fact that we have a very low voter turnout. Now, that's been interpreted in very differing ways. You know, less than half of voters tend to turn out for elections in Europe, of which I still include the UK, because I'm hopeful that, you know, that terrible decision will one day be rescinded. Good luck to you all. I take the view that poor voter turnout, however much that's been interpreted differentially by different people, some people will say, well, it just means that most people are pretty happy with what's going on. They're so happy that they'd rather go and have a coffee than come out to vote. I'm not a believer in that particular worldview, because I could tell you, as someone who struggles to get to the ballot box every 4 years, not because I'm keener to have a coffee, but because I can't figure out who, out of all these horrific options, I am meant to put my vote behind. And, you know, this strategy of the least worst, well, your country has shown us just how effective the least worst. I mean, you know, genocidal maniac, pick your poison. I think that there are a lot of people not only awakening to the fact that the way that so-called liberal democracy is operating is nothing close to the ethos of what those terms actually mean, but that also now the only way that we are going to reclaim power is through a fight back. And you mentioned the campuses, the US campuses. The student protests, which have obviously been primarily focused around Gaza, are actually much wider than the Gaza situation. They are part of a political rebellion that students are leading the way on, which says, enough is enough. When the people speak, we must be heard. And if we won't be heard, we will make ourselves heard. We will reclaim territory. In those spaces, we will establish principles, guidelines, philosophies, which we think should be the basis of society. And to give you an example, I mean, Columbia has published widely on the ethos of their student campuses, and I would highly encourage you to engage with how thoroughly students have actually been thinking about the kinds of societies that they would like to live in. But these are societies in which Passover is celebrated by all students, where people with different needs, whether they be less able-bodied students, people with allergies, people with differential needs, their needs are prioritized at the heart of these encampments, where actually authority is far less hierarchical, which isn't to say that there isn't leadership. There is leadership, but it isn't purely hierarchical. And in that, within these new structures that these students are showing, and they're students, they're 19, they're 20, they're 21. I'm not suggesting that they are going to find the solution to the profound crises in which we find ourselves, but I am saying to you that they are showing us the beginning of what needs to be a wrestling of power back, and it's not going to be handed to us. And so we have a fight on our hands. And I don't mean a political fight at the ballot box, because I think it's really clear that our current options in this country are Tories or Tories light, austerity or austerity maybe a little light. And none of that works for the people. None of that works for the majority of the people. And none of it strikes at the profound crises that we are facing. And the only way we are going to get the sort of change that we really need is, unfortunately, through a profound awakening of you, the people. We have to take to the streets. We have to take to direct action. We have to take to much more confrontational political tactics. Because at a certain point, we are being mugged off. Every single person in this room, presuming there's no Rishi Sunak buddy boys around here, but presumably, if you're from Bradford, if you're from surrounding areas, you are being mugged off most of all. And if you think that power is just going to hand you back that power graciously because you came and dropped a vote in the box, unfortunately, I don't think that that is the case. And I think the response to the campuses in particular shows you what awaits us if we do decide that the fight back is really on. Not, of course, that I'm suggesting that we have a widespread revolution, because that would be instigating violence, but you know.
You talk about a fight back, and of course, I think involved in that is also the fight back to the fight back, what we see, the backlash by state and security. We'll get more into your book in a minute, but I just wanted to highlight the fact that, picking up with where Mariam left off, that two things you mentioned in the book is, one is the importance of diversity, and the other is, citing Jacques Rancière, that democracy is really for the excluded. So I'd like to pick up on that in a minute. Salman, has liberal democracy ever been liberal, and has it ever been democratic? Because I think when we're looking at this topic, we need to be intellectually honest that blue pill would tell us that there was such a thing as liberal democracy, and maybe the red pill, Matrix reference, of course, is that perhaps it never has been. And I think it's not so much important to realize the reality of it, but I think more from planning strategies moving forward.
No, I think it's really important, and just pick up the point that both Anne and Miriam have made. There is a way that liberal democracy works as how we think the world should be, and because it's had a very good press. And we think that being liberal democratic is basically about the best way of living. And in a way, I think you started with Francis Fukuyama. The thing is that everyone sneers about him saying the end of history, but underneath it all, nearly all of us believe it to be the case, because we can't imagine anything different. And the problem right now is this, that we can imagine the end of the world. You can see all these movies that tell you the end of the world, but you can't imagine the end of capitalism, you can't imagine the end of liberalism, and you can't really imagine it. What would it look like? Because we've become so ingrained in everyday life, we actually live like liberals, or the image of liberal Democrats. The trouble is that, as you mentioned, liberalism and democracy has never been incompatible with racism, with imperialism, with classism. It's just that it wrote the books better. And the books that we get taught miss out all of those points. The things that we learn about, we don't actually understand or are told that liberalism has always had that dark side. And what is happening now, and I think Gaza is crucial here, is that the dark side of liberalism is coming to the fore, and it's being directed at the people who thought we were liberal Democrats and will never be directed at us. And I think that is the real key here. If you think about the experience of, let's say, the United States, and you talk about, and everyone talks about how terrible Trump is, the trouble is that Trump isn't that different if you're from any American president. If you're in Latin America, if you were in Southeast Asia, that's what American presidency was. You know, there's a whole thing about Americans may think of themselves as Superman, we experience them as Homelander. And that, I think, is really, really important to recognize that. So what is happening now is to defend certain kind of general ethos of white supremacy, to defend certain kind of values, the liberal order itself is being undermined by so-called liberals. You can see this not just in the United States, but in Germany. Germany's constitution put into place things that would prevent it from what happened in 1945. So it was basically based that we will be a law-governed society. But German politicians have said, in defense of what is Tel Aviv doing in Gaza, we are willing to break those laws. Now, that, think of that for a moment. That is a major, major capitulation to the idea that liberalism was about a rule-governed system. When you think about the idea of the international order, the rule-governed system, everyone remembers what was done when the Russians invaded Ukraine. How quickly it was said, look, we need to support the rule-based system. And suddenly, a couple of years later, people must think we have memories like goldfish, that we don't actually remember every single thing that was said that was wrong about Ukraine. There is nothing said about what is happening in Gaza. And that, I think, really puts us into this notion that we need to understand that liberalism that we all think was a good thing was a kind of a blip in the long history of the relationship between liberalism and democracy, and that blip is being undermined. And the difficulty is this, that, and I think Miriam is quite right, is that we are still dealing with that effect of a kind of hypocrisy. So even though we know and we can experience there's a crisis of representation, you can't actually find political voices, parties, organizations that will take on things that you want to be, you know, you want to believe in, we still have the illusion that actually this is being done in our name. And we have turned politics has become a spectator sport. We do it every 4 or 5 years or something like that. We're asked to play our little part, ask the ballot for a vote, and then just go away and not bother people again who really know how to do things. And I think even though we're heading towards this new, the elections coming in, I think you'd have to be either very naive or extremely optimistic to see a fundamental change in that way of thinking about what is the role of people. In the end, we are becoming almost superfluous to requirements that it doesn't really matter. And it's all become almost a kind of a fiction, a game in which we just have walk-on paths. And I think that is really the crisis that we're talking about liberal democracy, is that we can no longer believe in it, but we don't have the means to actually challenge it. We don't have the means to think beyond it. And for that, we just end up going, repeating ourselves in that cycle.
And despite the fact that we're actually seeing these contortions playing out in a much more visible role, you mentioned Germany. The German parliament just passed a law regarding people seeking naturalization of citizenship that they have to explicitly declare that Israel has a right to exist. They don't have to make a similar proclamation about Germany with the right to exist. And similarly, in the United States, as it's now become quite abundantly clear, you can criticize the American government, but lo and behold, if you go ahead and criticize the government of Israel, what then are the consequences of occurring?
On that very point, I just have to jump in and say, look, there's also this, the other part of the mask that has fallen, is that we've obviously always known that there's what in other countries gets called the deep state. Of course, there are only deep states out there. There's no deep state over here, right? What we've seen is candidates, when they do offer alternative policies, a la Jeremy Corbyn, whether or not he's your guy, by the way, but just objectively, as somebody who is coming forward with a very different political agenda, there being a witch hunt against this man, him being accused of, you know, all kinds of things that sort of delegitimize them. And of course, again, this is where Gaza has revealed so much of what was previously sort of so much speculated on, which was, you know, well, was there really a real problem about anti-Semitism within the Labour Party, or was this, you know, really just constructed to delegitimize Jeremy Corbyn? And of course, because anti-Semitism is such a serious thing, and that we all, I'm going to speak, and hopefully you'll join me, we all aspire to an anti-racist society. We all aspire to a society in which anti-Semitism is not permissible in any party. But then we also then come around when Gaza comes around and we suddenly see that, oh, now anti-Semitism is criticizing Israel? So now criticizing a state is anti-Semitic? Okay, now we can roll back and look at history a little bit differently. And it doesn't just apply, of course, just to Corbyn. It applies to many other areas where you can suddenly start thinking, oh, hold on, we were sold an explanation for this particular thing, Brexit, the NHS, you know, think of any number of the main political issues we've been facing in this country, and actually the solutions that we've been sold as being the necessary ones versus the ones that were offered by alternative candidates who have often been delegitimized through what I would call very, very dirty tactics. And now we're seeing those dirty tactics. It's very difficult to continue to believe in the charades. And that's the problem. Who still believes in the charade? Who, when you're watching a political discussion now, really believes in what is being discussed?
But I think this is really the dangerous point here, because in a way, you have a deep state or you have an establishment which doesn't believe in anything itself except holding on to its position of power.
And the accumulation of wealth.
Well, but I think even that becomes, it's almost become automatic in a way. There's a kind of a metaphor that a great kind of Zygmunt Bauman, a great kind of political philosopher, once said that we kind of live in a world where we're flying in a plane, but we just find out that there's no pilot. And the plane just keeps flying on automatic. And if you think about all the kind of recipes that we're offered for political change, they're almost like tick book exercises. They're also something that you can almost imagine. Take, for example, the expenditure on health or things like that. We're always told there's never enough money to spend on NHS, etc.
But there's money for war.
Or there's money for those kind of things can suddenly be found. There's money for the banks. There has been, how much money has been put in there?
So what we're talking about then is a form of democracy that is mandated to be docile. Yeah. That democracy must be neutered, democracy must be domesticated, democracy must be docile.
And you may raise that question of democracy as a spectator sport.
Yeah.
This morning, I was looking at people reacting to the debate, and putting forward alternative candidates. And time after time, they named actors. And a long time ago...
Tom Hanks.
Yes, yeah, Tom Hanks. I mean, really? And
really?
Yes, Tom Hanks.
Actually,
who was the other one? John
Stewart,
Michelle Obama.
If it's Tom Hanks as a bachelor party...
I would take Michelle Obama. I would take Michelle Obama.
Well, you
Obama.
Ought not to.
Yeah.
And this is what, and this is why, perfectly nice woman, very competent lawyer. Really, is that what you want? No, it's not.
Versus
you
Trump.
Want to grow leaders from the ground. You want to grow leaders who actually are engaged with this, not someone who doesn't want to do it necessarily. And I think part of the problem here is the focus is on leaders. You want to change your world, and you say, I'll elect a different person. Well, we had that moment. And I remember, as we were watching the returns of Obama's first term, that we had a friend, a communist friend from Algeria, who called us up in the middle of the election from Canada and said, you have shown the world you are a great nation. Well, we then proceeded to show the world that leaders don't make enough difference, that it is not just about electing a new person. And all of us in the global north are facing elections which, in a fundamental way, don't matter enough. The leaders cannot change all that they need to change, and the people think that they can do nothing without leaders. And of course, one of the really charming things about the encampment, but in a deep way, was in my encampment, which I went to daily, when the administration came to the students and said, well, we will talk to you, but we want your leaders. And the students said, we don't have leaders. That's a very important moment, because encased within it is the demand, you know, you don't speak to representatives, you speak to us. And we have to have avenues in which I can speak. One of the horrible things about equality, the problem with inequality, frankly, is not that Jeff Bezos, fool that he is, can buy a spaceship or a giant super yacht or that Oprah can have really large diamonds. I don't care if they have diamonds or even these silly things, although it's a massive self-indictment. It's that we don't have access, that newspapers are owned by consortia that are owned by often one man, often one particular man who we might name. And there is not that availability for you to make your voice heard. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why initially social media exploded, because it offered that opportunity, and then it took it away. Because anyone who's funding the troll farm or running the moderators controls what is said. So that's why equality matters. I mean, it doesn't matter that people can buy different things very much. It matters that they have differential power. And if that were possible, then things could open up. I mean, the other reason why I'm a little bit not... I mean, part of me thinks if the United States were a healthy democracy, even a healthier liberal democracy, Trump wouldn't matter. We've had a lot of really bad presidents. And one of the things I would do with my students was I'd put up a list of presidents and I'd say, tell me about them. Are any of them any good? Well, you get past the first four, and maybe Lincoln, maybe Roosevelt. After that, no one's willing to go to bat for them. And but it was all right. A healthy polity can have a bad leader. You won't always, I think, in a healthy polity, throw up bad leaders, but you can tolerate them. But it's not clear that we can tolerate them anymore. That's because we're not a robust democratic economy in which people have access to power and access to speech. That experience of going into the voting booth and saying, lesser of two evils, always a bad idea, or frustration. I have a colleague who says that the dominant democratic experience is frustration. And I think everybody feels at home with that statement. So we need to refuse to be told that this is what we have to settle for. And refuse to say, this is the only way, this is the only news. I have to subscribe to the Times, as I do, because it is the newspaper of record. These are things that we have a little more power over en masse as organized people.
I wanted to bounce off two things you were talking about, which were the frustration. I think frustration is 100% the order of the day. If I could see you all and I asked for a show of hands, I'm pretty sure frustration would be the issue that would get us all putting our hands up and sharing in that feeling. But what I think is really interesting is that the majority of people who are experiencing this frustration have done what all good democratic subjects should, which is, what did we do? We took to the streets. We took to the streets with placards. Sometimes we took to the streets with ironic placards, sarcastic placards, maybe even a placard suggesting that the Tory party presenting itself as a beacon of diversity and therefore an admirable and desirable form of government could be questioned, with maybe a picture of some coconuts, but apparently not, right? So you'll all be familiar with the story of Maria Hussein, who was arrested for holding up a placard which featured Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman with pictures of coconuts, which was then used as the basis of a charge of racist abuse, right? That she's a brown Asian woman, was racially abusing Rishi Sunak. So that, to me, was an indication of where we are at, right? That now even political satire is going to be used, and the same legislation that was presented as being in defense of minorities in this country is actually now being wielded against those very same people. And the protests are the other way in which, you know, good citizens have taken to the streets. They've said, okay, you guys want to push on with supporting Israel's genocidal campaign. We don't agree with it. The polls have said we don't agree with it. You're not listening to us. We're going to do what, you know, every citizen is permitted to do in a good democracy, take to the streets. And what happened? We have been met with brutality. We have been met with demonization. We have seen these marches branded as hate marches. This has been the dominant presentation of people taking to the streets, objecting to the mass murder of predominantly women and children. In what reality? In what reality? The reality in which Gaza reveals to us that we are so far gone that the government has no intention of listening to the people, and that if you try and make yourself heard on this issue or any other, you will be demonized, you will be punished, you will be imprisoned, and you will be silenced. And that's why I say very clearly to you, from somebody who is regularly present in these spaces, that this is not going to happen softly.
Gaza is, I think, critical, but this is much longer. There was Occupy,
right.
There was Black Lives Matter, and there have been...
Yeah. Also met with violence.
In some interesting ways. But these demonstrations are also, they're not just the leftist young. One of the things that struck me most about the Black Lives Matter demonstrations and the demonstrations after the death of George Floyd in my city were, I come out, and who's there? I'm sort of expecting a lot of young people of color. And what do I get? People who are older than me. White people coming in from the suburbs, because it isn't an identity issue. It's an issue of justice. And they think this is their cause, and they are right. So that radical inclusiveness, and they're also not carrying fancy posters. They're carrying pieces of cardboard on which they have written things like Black Lives Matter. So that the presence of the old white woman from suburbia holding up the cardboard sign, that tells you a lot. There are a lot of people who think this is our cause because it is the cause of justice. And I think that liberalism inclines us to want to describe it as a failure of inclusion, which it is, and that the regimes for encouraging inclusion have been turned against themselves, which they have. But it is also, these are also really basic issues. They are issues of fundamental rights. On the ground, people, your neighbors, see that. You see that. So that's what I want to focus on. There's an Arab philosopher, Al-Farabi, who I love very much, and he makes the argument that democracy will be diverse. There's no stopping it. People love it. He says, the democratic city, everyone wants to come. And when they are there, They eat each other's food, they marry each other. As he says, they have children of every hue. And so, in some ways, democracy will guarantee its own diversity. But when we try and manage it, we blow it. And the Germans are a superb example of this. They say, we don't want to be Nazis anymore, so we'll forbid certain kinds of speech. And what happens? That then gets weaponized against the very populations it's supposed to help.
I think it's important to have two minds about this, because, again, the model that we have of democracy, if it harkens back to anything, it does to sort of Athens. And we forget.
No.
But I'm saying in a kind of popular imagination, mm-hmm. that's what democracy is, and then people talk about that. And again, they find that the exclusions around the fact that, of course, democracy in Athens was only for men, it wasn't for foreigners, it wasn't for women, etc.
It was built on a slave economy.
And it was based on a slave economy. So in a way, you can have these kind of compatibilities. So one of the things that we need to do is broaden our imagination that goes beyond that kind of last 200 years of rewriting of history, in which we start thinking about democracy is actually what people can do when they come together, wherever they are, rather than something that comes together only once at a moment in ancient Athens, and from that you go all the way from Plato to NATO, and then you can take the steps. It's not how democracy works, or the way that we need to sort of rethink or broaden this category of democracy. We need to broaden this notion of what is it that we are trying to do here. And the basic thing is that human life, all humans, ultimately are social creatures. And what we're talking about is how we get along with each other and how we expand our notion of what our neighbors are, what are those we see as our being someone similar to ourselves, that we can actually engage with them. And it's that process of expansion. And I think the Black Lives Matter was a really, really interesting thing. Think about it for a minute. You have a situation that in Minneapolis, a city in the United States, an African-American is killed by a police officer.
Ferguson, tiny town.
Yeah. Now, if that happens in a way, why is it that then gets the largest demonstrations in the United States? And as Anna said, there weren't people of color, there were white people, suburban people, all of that. But why does it lead to the statues of slave owners in Bristol being thrown into the river? How is that chain made possible? And I think that is the thing that we need to think about. How is it that something like that can become a metaphor that everyone else can identify with? And in the way that we have to do this, when we have no platforms to be able to circulate that, and the difficulty I have with demonstrations is that they require a lot of organization, they require a lot of effort, and the idea of the state is always, look, you'll get bored of it. It's the same thing with the camps. You will get bored of it. And we need to find mechanisms to be able to sustain these kind of things, which means organization, ultimately. And without organization, you have enthusiasm, and that lasts, but enthusiasm is always going to be temporary. And unless we actually organize and think, what is it that we are actually trying to do here? And we need to demand more than saying, stop this latest iteration of horror. We're talking about something much more systemic, saying, we want a better world. And that is what we're trying to look for. And that is what our demand should be.
I think the other thing that was so important... I think the other thing that was so important about what you said, Salman, regarding the connection between Minneapolis and Bristol, was it was a far more thorough response to what brought us there, which was the fact that the Atlantic slave trade actually did go across the Atlantic, that the issue of George Floyd was not just parochial to Minneapolis, it had a connectivity elsewhere. Yeah. And so I think that's an important...
But I want to add to that, because think about it again for a minute, okay? So normally when some of things like this happens, like the murder of George Floyd, and the first response is, well, it happened, it's terrible, you've got a few bad apples in the police force, we'll get rid of them, that's the end of the matter. And it's always a few bad apples, and you can see that, and those excuses made. The trouble is that people did not find that satisfactory, because they understood this few bad apples story doesn't work, because the way that the policing itself in the United States has been constructed is on the history of enslavement. The original police forces were often basically there to capture and recapture escaped slaves. The idea of violence against black bodies has been historically embedded. This is why when you look at, for example, in Ferguson, you can see the techniques used in West Bank, and you can see the American cities directly. So what I'm trying to say here, and I think it's really important to grab at this, is that there is a level of rising political consciousness about people who can understand what happened in Minneapolis as part of a kind of greater colonial way that we still think of ourselves. And this is why when students are demonstrating, they say decolonize. Decolonizing isn't just a slogan, it is actually a way of connecting the world that we live in and its inequalities, inheritances, which disenfranchise us slowly, have disenfranchised us totally. And that the decolonization is really about emancipating ourselves as much as it's about emancipating the colonies. Because ultimately, we are also colonized. And all the violence that is being used in other places will and does become used on us. If you look at, for example, the anti-terror legislation, it was always promised that it was going to be used to keep out bad dudes, as Trump might say. And eventually, it's also being used to make sure that you put your bins in order, and then you say, well, demonstrations. Actually, this reinforces. A spectator sport of politics isn't just done to theater. There are actually means to stopping you actually trying to do anything more than that.
I was really touched by your invocation of a word in Arabic, shabbi, which means of the people, and yet, of course, how it sounds like shabby. And you use both of these to describe democracy, that it's of the people and that democracy should be shabby. It shouldn't be homogenized. It shouldn't be sanitized. It reminded me of when I used to play tennis. Whenever I would get a new racket, I was paranoid about it getting scraped. And in fact, my game suffered because I wouldn't reach down for any ball that would scrape it. But once I got the first scrape on it, the racket was broken in, and I was able to liberate myself. I was still terrible, but at least I made a better effort. And I think that in many ways, that's your book, what made it so remarkable for me was to see then this idea that democracy shouldn't be, in order to protect it, you have to get it bruised up a little bit, and you have to get it dirty, and that's okay. I'd like to open it up to you now, and I think hopefully we should have a roving mic. I see a question right off the bat here.
Just thoughts that I've been having. I've spent a lifetime loving this kind of discussion and loving these kind of thoughts and thinking about politics and religion and history. And most belatedly in my life, coming to ecology and thinking about nature and how nature works. And I had these thoughts that I've been fermenting for a while, how when you look at how farming works and how ecology's been, I've just been reading Silent Spring on the bus on the way here. And the idea that when there's a problem in nature, you just spray it and get rid of it. So when a part of your community becomes problematic, you just kill it. You just bash it on the head, or you imprison it, or you isolate it. And the approach, instead of nurturing biologically healthy communities that hold all these things in check, when you were talking about nurturing a healthy democratic populace, made me think that this is the same, and actually we lose a lot by keeping the realms of ecology and politics separate. And when I saw the cover of your book, Wild Democracy, I was like, huh. And, you know, soil is dirty. I think soil is like the people. It's the bedrock. If you nurture your soil and it's healthy and diverse and full of completely different organisms that interact with one another, then you have a healthy ecosystem. And actually, I'm just thinking, like, the soil is us. The soil is we, the people. And if we have a healthy education system and a healthy soil that's nurturing diversity, then naturally we would keep in check these violent impulses. What would you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. And at one point I thought about putting weeds on the cover. I mean, it's that desire to rid yourself of things that are a problem, but you don't know how they work in the ecosystem. So that this is why I was drawn to anarchy, because a lot of things, just leave them alone. Let people live their lives. It may not be the life you want to live. It may not be a life you approve of. It may be a life you think is wrong. But you don't know what role it's going to play in that ecosystem. And you can respond to it, but let people live their lives. Let them say what they please. And then see what can be made of it. See what they're doing in that system. It was very interesting to me that one of the anarchist theorists that I was reading in this regard, Kropotkin, was a biologist. And he thought those two things were very intimately linked in exactly the kind of way that you describe. So, yep.
And in the zeal to keep your lawn looking perfect, using pesticides kills bees.
And you.
Not yet.
Roundup, not a good thing for humans.
My question really is about fear, and it's about overcoming fear as an individual and as part of a community, of being able to interact, you know, and do some of these really positive things that we all, I'm sure, in the room want to engage with. But when a system is underpinned by violence, ultimately, or imprisonment, you know, what can we do to try and become more confident and overcome that fear? Because really, it is there, isn't it? The law is against us. If we want to collectivize, if we want to come together, if we want to make a change, how do we give ourselves that confidence, really? That's just a thought, really, for you guys.
I think that's what you need organization for. That's why you need to gather for. Because one of the things about the demonstration it does, it actually means that you're not the only person. So it's not just fear, it's also isolation. You often think you're the only person who thinks like that because everything on the TV, everything, you don't have any voice, you don't see anyone like you or saying things like you. So when you go on a demonstration, you suddenly see there are many other people around you. This is why demonstrations are really, really important. It's not just the actual act of going in a demonstration, but losing your fear among others who also have the fear on their own and learning from that. And one of the things about demonstrations do, and the camps have done, they become educational elements. And you start thinking, actually, I have to learn to be courageous. And it's easier to be courageous when you know there are other people who have to learn to be courageous as well. And I think that is really, really important. We have lost the ability to think of ourselves as part of communities and societies. Many of you would remember Margaret Thatcher made the famous kind of statement, there's no such thing as society, there's only individuals and their families. And what we have to try and recover is actually there is something called society. And I think the pro-Palestinian demonstrations demonstrate exactly that, because the majority of the people in those demonstrations aren't Palestinian, aren't Arab speakers, they're not even Muslim. And they're saying we're actually demonstrating there because we recognize a common humanity which has been refused to us. And I think it's through those kind of gatherings and things we learn to how to become courageous in these settings.
But you're also thinking about this in a kind of daily life community way, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I am actually, because I've been on a lot of demos, yeah. And yeah. It's about, you know, because, and they don't seem to work actually, you know, anti-war demos, you know, anti-poll tax, all that stuff, it didn't really work. And it's about how can we actually change things, yeah, in our communities, you know, and take that power back like you've been talking about, yeah.
Right, and it's, I think we have to admit to ourselves that this is not easy, that often working across ethnic lines or racial lines or religious lines is uncomfortable, and that's all right. Not only is that all right, that's what learning looks like. That's what political progress looks like, is you are faced with something that seems to you intractable, and you listen, and you talk, and you find a way. And you let the other people speak. And sometimes in these small interactions, you need to step back. There have been many times as a white woman I thought, this is not my time to talk. We have to do that work on a daily basis and not avoid it because we feel uncomfortable or because we're afraid of making other people uncomfortable or making them feel unsafe. I mean, this feeling unsafe thing needs to get thrown right out the window, because democracy is not a safe space. Democracy is a dangerous space, and we need to learn to live in it.
Just very, very quickly, I just wanted to very point. Let's also not forget that demonstrations have been successful, and don't believe the hype when they say they haven't been successful. The fact that we don't have the poll tax is because of anti-poll tax demonstrations. The fact that people can vote here is because of demonstrations. The fact that you have any kind of health and safety protection at work is because of strike actions and demonstrations. So I think there is a narrative which will always say, oh, if there's no point in doing it, it never happens. It's our impatience and our inability to remember the struggles that took place to get us the ability to do the things that we can do and we take for normal. And it's one of the things we have to be doing is recovering those memories, because they can help us for a plan and think about the future.
And learn from the past as well, yeah.
Yeah, learn from the past, yeah.
Can I just add one small thing to this? Because I hear this a lot within the movements that I'm involved with. And what I regularly say is, if you think, not you personally, but like if one thinks like entering a movement, that we're going to, you know, in our generation, in the next year, you know, reverse all of this damage that's been done. It's not going to happen. However, you, in your world, there is one thing that you can focus on and decide that you want to change that. It may be, for example, that you would like, you know, in your child's school, for the word Palestine to not be taboo. Because, by the way, as a parent, I can tell you that it is. That going into a school and saying, can we talk about Palestine today, is a massive problem. And that should not be the case. So there are small wins that might appear small, but that cumulatively are part of the change, because the change in the other direction also happened cumulatively. It happened drip by drip. Oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. That community center closed, that local theater closed. Oh, there's no more local gazette. All of these little changes changed what? The spaces in which we could come together and organize and talk and argue with people who have similar material interests to our own. And so what I would really urge is that although we should all keep our sights on the bigger picture, really, you know, I have people who come to me and say, I'm a baker. What can I do? I say, bake a cake with a Palestinian flag on it. That you think that's nothing, but the visibility of the Palestinian flag in a public sphere where we are told that this is a taboo is its own FU. So do it. Make those cakes, wear that flag, wear that keffiyeh, send your kid to school, sorry, sending the child as, you know, frontline fodder, with a Palestine t-shirt, especially if you're white. Now, please hear me, especially if you're white. And believe me, we have more scope to push on these things than any other community. We have to be the ones that push the boundaries. And the higher up you go, the privilege ladder, where I'm middle class, I have more privilege than a white working class person. I have more responsibility to push those boundaries than anybody else. But don't expect to change the big ones. Believe me, the small little wins also will teach you about the landscape. It will teach you about the limits, you know, because as you get closer to them, you'll feel the heat. You'll feel the heat and you're like, okay, all right, that's where that is right now. How do I work around it? But it's only by getting stuck in that you start to see. And the more you get stuck in, by the way, and this has been my own experience, the more you realize how closeted they have made us today. It really is only when you start to get down on the ground that you realize how far our freedoms have really been profoundly eroded. We talk a lot about these strongman politics abroad, right? We have strongman politics here. You've got to watch the models that our countries are exporting or trying to export or encourage in other places, in the Middle East, elsewhere. This model of give people a certain level of material wealth whilst withdrawing their ability to participate and influence political outcomes. If you look at the UAE, you have a perfect encapsulation of a profoundly authoritarian state. Projected in the public imagination as somehow a Disneyland. What kind of a Disneyland is it when if you say one thing on any political matter that you will end up in jail? That's no Disneyland. That's no Disneyland in my world. And so I'm just want us to be alert to the reality that there is a certain level of material comfort that we are being sold as the carrot against which we have to accept compliance. And to that, I want to say, I'm sorry, fuck that. Fuck that. We are not accepting that. There is no level of material comfort that should ever allow us to concede on our freedoms. And we are way past that. So please, in whatever sphere you're in, push your elbows out. Push those elbows out. Make yourself feel heard. Make yourself a cog. Make yourself a problem. Because pushing back against authoritarian tendencies is going to make us a problem. And my final word, if I may, there are generations, older generations of people, our elders in our community, some of them fought their own battles for which they were arrested, right? They've had their own encounters with the police. Maybe they don't need to get a job no more. Maybe they can be arrested. Maybe if they're willing, they might be more willing to be on the front line. That's all I'm going to say. And we thank you. We thank you for your sacrifices.
Thank you so much to you.
Thank you.
Book or no book, I'm happy to talk
for,
to you.
For coming. Thank you, Salman Sayed. Thank you, Miriam Francois. And of course, thank you, Ann Norton. Enjoy your time at the Bradford Literature Festival.
you for listening. And thank you to everyone who attended our 2025 Bradford Literature Festival and helped to make it such a success. You'll be able to listen back to some of our selected events in the new series, coming soon.